Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Tomorrow in our 11 o'clock hour, as always on Fridays, it's Film Week. Our critics are Wade Major, Leah Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. And they'll tell us about The Boss Baby, Family Business, which is another comedy animated film in the Boss Baby series. The Forever Purge, the Purge series of action thrillers, is back with another installment. The one and only Dick Gregory, which is a Showtime documentary I've had the pleasure of seeing, which is a terrific look at a very complicated, extraordinarily talented comedian and activist, Dick Gregory, and the re-release of the 1955 crime film, The Lady Killers, from Britain's Ealing Studios, a real favorite of our critics. We'll hear about that as well. Those are just a few of the films coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock, Film Week, right here on KPCC. Well, just less than 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, announced there will be a new federal survey looking at boarding schools in the United States for Native American kids and to see if there are any burial sites similar to what's been found in Canadian investigations that have found the remains of up to 751 people, most likely children, this in the province of Saskatchewan. We're going to take a look with that in mind at the history of U.S. Native American boarding schools, and particularly Sherman Indian School right here in Riverside in Southern California, which is a very different institute today than it was back in the years shortly after its founding. Joining us is Brenda Child, Professor of American Studies and American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. Her many books include Boarding School Seasons, American Indian Families, 1900 to 1940. Professor Child, thank you for being with us on Air Talk.
My pleasure. It's nice to be with you.
Let's talk about how many of these schools they were and where they were located. What's the history of the Native American boarding schools?
Right. So the history of the boarding schools came out of really the 19th century. So if you think of the era, you know, of the Indian Wars, that's, you know, kind of chronologically the era. The first of these government boarding schools was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and that school opened in 1879. It became sort of famous in the early 20th century because of a famous student there, Jim Thorpe, the incredible.
Yeah.
Athlete. But, you know, what the boarding schools were kind of what was going on with Native people at the time. You know, if you think of, you know, as I was suggesting, the Indian Wars, there were some Native people, like, say, the Apaches in the Southwest, who were resistant to the reservation system. They were actually prisoners of war at the time of the founding of Carlisle. And so what the government decided to do, the parents were incarcerated. They took the children, the Apache children, to the Carlisle school. And there were other tribes like the Lakotas. My own grandfather, I'm from northern Minnesota, I'm Ojibwe, he was an early Carlisle student as well. So that's kind of chronologically the history of when the boarding schools first appeared.
Now, your grandmother went to an American Indian boarding school in South Dakota, is that right?
Yes. Then, you know, a little bit later on, she was a boarding school student in the 1920s, And that was still the assimilation era, right? So the idea of the government boarding schools is that Native students were supposed to be retrained, re-educated. They would not speak their tribal languages. Hopefully, they would convert to Christianity, and they would receive a kind of basic education. The boarding schools emphasized manual trades for Native people. They didn't have lofty aspirations for them, but rather they thought that kids or young people would learn a vocation. And for young girls, that meant domestic service. For young guys, that would mean a whole array of kind of industrial working class trades.
Love to hear from any of our listeners who attended an American Indian school anywhere in the country, or perhaps you had a family member who told you stories of what that experience was like if they attended one of these boarding schools. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can share that experience on our Facebook page, the Air Talk Facebook page, or tweet at AirTalk as well. We're talking with University of Minnesota Professor of American Studies and American Indian Studies, Brenda Child, author of the book Boarding School Seasons. Give us a sense of how much language and culture was lost as a result of such a high percentage of these kids being totally, not just removed from their culture, but strictly told that they couldn't practice any of their culture.
Right. Well, that was a difficult part of boarding school history for American Indian people, this kind of disconnection from your family and community. When I wrote Boarding School Seasons a number of years ago, I went into the government archives and started looking at the letters that parents, family members, children, even school administrators wrote at that time. And actually, it was sort of encouraging to do that because by looking at letters, you could see the connections that remained. So parents, just because their children were in another state going to a federal boarding school, the parents and families, of course, didn't give up on their children in any sort of way. And so there was always that I don't know what you call it, because the families stayed connected to their children, there, you know, it wasn't like a complete sort of re-education that was able to take place, right? Because kids were resistant, parents were resistant to the policies, boarding school kids continuously ran away from the school. So it's kind of encouraging that even though there was this forced acculturation at the time, that Indian people, even young children, maintained a lot of their cultural ideas. I think about my own grandmother. Her dad had been a student at Carlisle, but they lived in an Indian community in northern Minnesota. And so when my grandmother came back from boarding school as a young woman, she returned to speaking her language and continued in the kind of Ojibwe ways of making a living and so forth. She married a man who was a little older than her, my grandfather. He spoke only Ojibwe. So not everybody was completely, you know, acculturated, but there were some people, especially if they didn't have strong family ties at home or if they'd lost, you know, their parents or were orphans. Some of those children were very vulnerable and spent a lot of time in government boarding schools without family and community.
Professor Child, do these American, Native American boarding schools significantly differ from their Canadian counterparts?
Yeah, so I think that the boarding schools in the history of the U.S. have a lot in common with the Canadian residential schools, especially in their 19th century origins, right? Everybody had the same idea, you know, of now what we call settler colonialism, of how to how to solve what people considered the Indian problem. And of course, in the United States, the big thing about government boarding schools that's important to remember is that they coincided with a land policy in the United States. And so Native people were actually dispossessed of more of their land. Millions of acres passed out of ownership of tribes at this time. And so the boarding schools were kind of a place of re-education because they were, federal government was saying, well, the Indians don't need to live on the land. They don't need these connections of culture anymore. And so you have to look at the boarding schools as being kind of a twin policy with the land policies. So that's where I see kind of the big similarities between Canada and the United States. At the same time, one major, I would say there are a couple major differences between Canada and the U.S. One is that the Canadian government, for whatever reason, kind of farmed out Indian education to the church organizations. In the United States, that wasn't the case. These were federal boarding schools and government-run schools, and bureaucrats and teachers and such were hired by the federal government to work in these schools. The other big difference from Canada and the U.S. is that boarding schools kind of lasted. I mean, the heyday of the assimilation movement was kind of a 50-year period from Carlisle in 1879 up until the 1930s. So imagine the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. This is the time in the United States when public school education came to dominate Indian education. Now, in Canada, the boarding schools, the residential schools up there, continued for another 50 years, right? So generationally, there it's kind of a different sort of story.
Well, and I also wonder, because just some of the reading that I've done over the years about the Native American boarding schools, it does seem that there were some people who, you know, their view was, and I guess this is not surprising for that time early on, was that the only way that Native Americans would be economically successful is if they fully acculturate to the dominant culture, and that part of that was leaving the culture of birth behind and essentially becoming, quote, American by leaving behind their tribal identities. How much of that sort of thinking was at the core of the instruction?
Well, I think that was the core of what boarding schools were all about in terms of federal policy. But I always look at that as a kind of a rhetoric, right? In some ways, that was kind of an empty rhetoric. Because what happened during that 50 years of government boarding schools in the U.S., as I was suggesting, is that the General Allotment Act was passed. Native land was privatized, and millions of acres of land passed out of Indian ownership in the United States. And so when you think about it, Indians at the end of the boarding school era and at the end of the allotment era in the 1930s were much poorer than they were before. And so you have to look at the reality of what happened to Native people during that half century and not just the rhetoric of uplift citizenship, because it was a great period of you know, land theft and dispossession. And so it's hard to see that Native people are going to be uplifted and fully enter American society and all those things when they had been so stripped of their land.
We're talking with Professor Brenda Child, University of Minnesota, Professor of American Studies and American Indian Studies. We'll continue with the curator of the Sherman Indian Museum in Riverside. It's on the campus of Sherman Indian High School. Amanda Wixon will be with us. She's also at the Autry Museum of the American West and a PhD candidate at UC Riverside. We'll be back in just 1 minute as we talk about Native American schools nationally and here in Southern California. Just another reason to enjoy the Independence Day weekend, that marathon of Terry Gross and Fresh Air on KPECC on Monday. We're talking right now about the history of American Indian schools nationally and here in Southern California. With us, the curator at the Sherman Indian Museum at the Sherman Indian Institute High School in Riverside, Amanda Wixon. And thank you very much for being with us today. Share with us a bit about Sherman's history.
Well, thank you for having me today. Sherman was actually, Professor Childs spoke about the Carlisle Institute, which is the first school, and Sherman was the last of the 25 federal boarding schools and considered in many ways the flagship, one of the most beautiful at the time. So, and actually the architecture was quite famous at the time. It was Spanish Revival, which was very popular.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful campus.
It was, yeah. In the it started actually over in Paris in 1892, and a small vocational agricultural program consisted primarily of California native children taken from local tribes, also on Kaweah territory. But in 1901, the superintendent, Harwood Hall, together with Frank Miller, who was a very famous early promoter of Riverside, lobbied Congress to move the facility or actually build a new facility about 20 miles away in Riverside. So ostensibly it was because of water resources, right? They didn't have enough water in Paris for this extensive agricultural program that they had planned. But also, it was a way to provide cheap labor to the local, in the form of the native students, to the local Christian families, and also to establish a tourist attraction in Riverside, which Frank Miller was heavily part of.
We should just mention, for those who aren't familiar with the Riverside County community of Paris, it's P-E-R-R-I-S. We're not talking about the French city. For those who aren't familiar. So you mentioned tourism a part of this. Was this with the idea that the students would go on to work in the tourism industry, or that somehow they would be an attraction themselves?
Both, actually. Frank Miller's original idea was to have some of the native students at Sherman work in his famous Mission Inn in Riverside, which they did from time to time, but also as a tourist attraction in itself, the site. Frank Miller also owned a share in the streetcar. The streetcar actually ended right in front of the Sherman campus, and it was advertised through magazines like Charles Lummis, another early California promoter out west. It was advertised to come, where can you see Indians for so cheap? You can just take the train out, take a streetcar, and you can tour the school for the day. It was not fenced off originally, and so it was hosted sometimes upwards of 500 visitors a day.
Wow.
While the students were there.
And culturally, what was going on in arts and crafts, in language, in other forms of education? Was there cultural eradication that was taking place at Sherman as at these other schools that had been founded earlier?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Professor Childs mentioned that, you know, Carlisle was that forerunner. So all of the schools followed that model of stripping cultural practices away from the students that were there. So certainly there was, you know, I think, I don't know what she mentioned, but it was primarily a vocational school, established as a educational school. But, you know, according to oral histories, there was very little of that going on, especially in the early years, more vocational. And even it affected things, like you said, like the art program, where students, instead of learning their own cultural practices in their own community, were forced to learn other cultural practices from other communities taught by non-natives. So we're talking incalculable losses of traditional knowledge in terms of gathering materials, practicing reciprocity in the environment, and, you know, performing certain cosmological practices that are important for the health of your tribe. So once you take away all of that knowledge, it becomes sort of an empty practice.
You think of all that was lost culturally and in language. So now when native teachers are at Sherman, give us a sense of what the curricula is like now.
Certainly. So as you mentioned, it was, you know, the early years was that assimilative program, and then it continued through to the 1940s with the special Navajo program, when the government deemed that the Navajo people needed to have forced education. And so it was primarily served Navajo students. And eventually they started trickling in. That lasted about 15 years from the 40s to the 50s, and then more tribes started to trickle in, and now they serve dozens and dozens of tribes nationally. The big change, I think, besides the events of the 1960s and the civil rights movement and you know, the AIM movement and other Native American organizations that brought attention. A lot of the Sherman students that had graduated went back to work at Sherman. Now it's called Sherman Indian High School. It became accredited in 1971. They came back to work, and they are responsible really for changing some of the curricula and adding some of this programming that is not really, was never sponsored by the government, including indigenous languages like Lakota, Kaweah, in basketry right now. The director of the museum, Maureen Sisquak, is the cultural traditions leader, and so she teaches a whole program of different cultural practices where the students can engage in not only their own culture, but other cultures as well. So it looks a lot different than it used to.
Yeah, and is there a significant place for elders as well to come in to talk about traditions that, you know, they may be one of the few survivors who could relay those traditions?
Absolutely. It's a unique place. Out of the 25 original schools, there's only 4 federal boarding schools left. And so, of course, the enrollment is not as what it once was. At one time, it was up to 1,500 students. Now it averages about 300 to 400. But certainly, yeah, there's lots of opportunities for elders to come, and parents, of course, are not barred from the campus as they once were.
Yeah.
So there's many family days, powwows, a lot of community events for everyone.
All right. Thank you so much for talking about it. Curator of the Sherman Indian Museum, Amanda Wixon. Amanda, just briefly, at the museum, what can people see about Sherman's history?
It's also a teaching museum. It is private, so it's by appointment. But a lot of the early history we have, we're one of the few institutions actually that houses our own records. They weren't surrendered to the National Archives. And so we have yearbooks, we have thousands of images, artifacts, trophies, things related to school history, as well as California Indian history as well. We have quite a few school groups that come through.
Wow, this sounds great. Again, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Amanda Wixon, curator of the Sherman Indian Museum on the campus of Sherman Indian High School in Riverside. She's assistant curator at the Autry Museum of the American West and at UC Riverside, candidate for her PhD as she does research in Native American history, especially on the federal boarding schools. My thanks to Brenda Child, professor of American Studies and American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. Her books include Boarding School Seasons. Thank you so much for joining us. A reminder that Fresh Air is coming up next on KPCC. Tomorrow at 11 o'clock, it's Film Week, of course, coming out of an hour of Air Talk. Our critics will tell us about The Forever Purge, the latest in the Purge series of horror thrillers. And we've got the very different animated comedy, The Boss Baby Family Business, the newest installment of the Boss Baby series as well. Have a great afternoon. I look forward to talking with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.